Front matter. A theft in a small town. John W. Partington. Published by John W. Partington. Copyright 2024 John W. Partington. ISBN 978-1-989973-69-1. License warning. This book is licensed for your personal enjoyment only. If you're listening to this book and did not purchase it, or it was not purchased for your use only, then please consider making a donation to encourage more ebooks in the future. Thank you for respecting the hard work of this author. Any similarity to persons alive or dead is purely coincidental. Acknowledgements. I'd like to thank my editing team, Amal Shikimsi, Spilas Raka, and Jerry Kroll. They provided some wonderful suggestions and insights. I'd also like to thank my wife for putting up with me. I have a lot of issues, which she views with compassion and love. Talking about the imaginary people in my head having adventures is one of the things she puts up with. Chapter 1. A Funeral. I can't fart in a thong. I know that women aren't supposed to flutter in public, especially not at a funeral, but I have gas. Last night was Taco Tuesday, and now I'm paying the price. It's not that I can't toot, but I didn't want visible panty lines ruining the cut of my dress at my mom's funeral. I wore a thong, and now my blowhole is sealed with satin fabric. I wince as my stomach churns. Jessica, you okay? Peter whispers to me, mistaking my gas pain as sorrow. I love my mom and am heartstricken to see her depart, but I really have to pass gas. I'll be fine, I whisper back. It's a lot to take in right now. I'm not even listening to what the priest is saying. I'm more interested in making sure my children don't cause a scene. Chet is behaving very well, for Chet. He's hunting earthworms in a freshly dug grave at the other end of the small graveyard. Normally, it wouldn't be allowed, but now is not the time to scream at my son to behave. Ariel is standing a bit behind me and holding my hand. Her head is right at waist level. If I flutter, she'll know right away. She'll take it to the face, and it's more than I can expect for her to keep the event to herself. She has a stunned look on her face. Granny Silver was her favorite grandparent and the last elder on my side of the family. My dad is a couple of years younger than my mom. Peter's parents are still alive, but quite frankly, are real jerks. They do all the family things, send a check on birthdays and Christmas, and visit twice a year. I could understand that if they lived on the other side of the country, or even 4 or 5 hours away by car. But they live in the next town over, on the other side of the big city. It's less than an hour on the weekend, without traffic. When Chet was 4, he stepped on their dog's tail. It was a calamity, and I was told Chet was too much of a handful for proper visits. The dog has long since died, but we're still not encouraged to visit. Bree sighs with a deep yawn and then continues drooling out the side of her mouth. She's strapped into the baby harness that Peter is wearing across his chest. She shakes as a whole body hiccup contorts her frame. Then she smiles ever so sweetly. Did she just fart? I whisper to Peter. You can't smell it, he asks back. I've got cover. If I squeak out a toot, nobody will notice over the baby's gas. I clench up and try to release a silent bomb. The priest pauses right at that moment of no return. What sounds like air escaping from a latex balloon squeals over the silent graves. Everybody stops listening to the sermon and looks at me. I do the only thing I can. Excuse you, I turn to Peter. His eyes narrow, but he can see the plea in my face. Excuse me, he repeats. Taco Tuesday. We didn't make the best dietary decisions given the events of the next morning. Thank you, I murmur. You owe me, he mutters back. Clarice Silver is laid to rest in the ground without much more incident. Everybody packs up their stuff, folding chairs and stools. We're that type of community. Most of Mom's friends were as elderly as she was and couldn't be expected to stand an entire 40 minutes while the casket made its way to the final rest stop. Peter takes Bree and Ariel to the car while I go find Chet. I find him lying down in the grave, quiet and peaceful. I would think he's asleep except for the impish grin on his lips. Let's go, Chet, I say in my best don't mess with Mom voice. I can't, he replies. I'm a corpse. Be a zombie. Get in the car. Infect the whole family, I say. Is 12 too old for this sort of shenanigan? I have no idea. Kids don't come with a manual. There are all sorts of books on how to raise the best child. I know. I read them all, and they all give contradicting information for situations that never come up in my life. Not a single one of the books I read ever talked about coaxing my son out of an open grave. Cool. He jumps out of the grave and starts to stagger toward the car. It's a long day. Everyone in town comes over to my house to express their condolences. Mom was a popular woman with a lot of friends. They all brought food. Most of them brought jelly molds, frequently with soft fruit in it. That was a favorite of my mom's. I'm not sure how that relates to me and my family. My mom also liked money. Nobody brought that. The evening is a somber affair. Ariel is really shaken. Peter tells his best dad jokes to her, but she's not even cracking a smile. Eventually, I see him crouch down to her level, look her in the eye, and dispense some fatherly advice. I don't hear what he says over the press of guests, but she stiffens her lip and seems resolved. At the end of the day, and about 30 cousins later, but no in-laws, Peter and I are settling into bed. I squirm into his side. A long day, I say. Uh-huh, he agrees. Crap. I bolt upright. What's wrong? He gets ready to dash into action. I forgot my stool, I answer. Your stool, he asks. At the graveyard. I brought a stool in case I needed it. It's the nice one I use for pottery. Truthfully, I potted once and didn't like it. However, the stool is really comfortable. I'll go get it. Get it in the morning, Jess. It's almost midnight. Do you really want to wander around a graveyard at midnight? I guess not, but it had better be there tomorrow. Nobody is going to steal a stool. The next morning, I got up bright and early to recover my stool. I get to the graveyard and start to wander around. When I reach my mother's grave, I pull out my phone and call Peter. Can you call the police? I ask him. The police aren't going to do anything over a missing stool, he complains. That's not it, I reply. I'm standing beside Mom's grave. It's been dug up, and the coffin is open. Somebody stole your mom, Peter gasps. No, the body is here, but all her jewelry is missing. Somebody plundered Mom's grave. Can you call the cops? The police arrive. Lots of them. They put up caution tape and start looking for clues. They talk to each other a lot, talk on radios, and smoke cigarettes, which they throw into the open grave once my mom's casket is removed. They take the body to hunt for more clues. Finally, the lead detective comes over to where I'm standing. Richmond is too small to have its own police force, so the cops came from the big city near us. Really, we're just part of the big city, but still fiercely independent about our border unless we need help. Okay, Mrs. Smith, the lead dick starts to talk to me. I'm still feeling numb about the whole situation. Silver, I correct him. Okay, Silver. That's pretty. Silver, can you tell me why you came here this morning? He asks. No, my name is Jessica Silver. My husband is Peter Smith, I reply. So, you're not Silver Smith, he asks. No, I can already see the rabbit running down this hole and brace myself for the interrogation. But your husband's last name is Smith. Your last name is Silver, he clarifies. Yes. I didn't want to give up my maiden name or hyphenate, I explain. Why not, he asks. I didn't want to be Jessica Silversmith. I wait for that to process, and then a smirk crosses his lips ever so briefly. Okay, Mrs. Silver. Can you tell me why you came here this morning? Jessica, I respond. Who is Jessica, and why were you meeting her in a graveyard? He asks. No, call me Jessica, and I came here to pick up my stool that I forgot at the funeral. That's when I came across Mom's grave and found it open. What happens when you find the grave robbers? They'll be charged with an offense against moral conduct as it relates to interference with a dead body. That's a 5-year prison term, but it's unlikely we'll catch them. What do you mean, I stammer? It's not like they left their business card or any real clues. This is a nuisance crime. We might be able to recover the jewelry if it shows up in a pawn shop, but the perps are going to get away with it. Probably, he says. Then why go through all this malarkey, I ask. So you can file a claim with your insurance. Insurance companies like a police report when dealing with theft. You'll get an email with the report once it's ready. This is, quite frankly, a small potatoes dead-end case. There's very little we can do for you. How is this justice, I ask. Jessica, we're not superheroes. There's no evidence, and nobody really got hurt. Our hands are tied. We have real crime to deal with, he says. So, how do we solve this crime, I ask. Solve it yourself, he laughs at his own joke. All right, crew, he raises his volume to shout to the cops in the graveyard. Let's pack it up. Meet you at HQ. Chapter 2, The Grave. I need a partner. That is, a crime-solving partner, not a new husband, though at times that seems like a good idea whenever Peter frustrates me. All good crime solvers have a partner as backup, at the very least to bounce ideas, foil hypotheses, and help solve the crime without interfering. The problem is that I don't have any friends. I had devoted the last 12 years of my life to my children and was only starting to come out of mommy land. Then we had Bree, and she sucked me right back in. I love my daughter, and she's a good baby, but her timing needs work. As I said, I don't have friends, but I do have clients from my short-lived career as a prostitute. I know nothing about the crime other than somebody had dug up my mother and stolen her jewels. I need to know more about the actual event, and I know somebody who can help me. I walk up the ramp to the door and then knock. The house is starting to show a little wear after the winter, but I know Sergeant Jonathan Matters will hire somebody to take care of it shortly. He's that sort of man. Strong, resolute, handsome, and tragically flawed. I see the blurred image roll in behind the glass, and then the door opens. A chiseled man wearing a flannel shirt and running shorts opens the door from his wheelchair. From the waist up, he is the most striking person I have ever met, the kind of man who melts butter with a smile. From the waist down, he simply isn't. He has no legs, not even stumps. Jessica, he smiles broadly. To what do I owe this pleasure? He waves me in. I need to know about digging, I answer. Specifically, how long it takes to dig a grave. And you came to me, he asks with a confused tone. I figure a grave and a trench are about the same size, more or less, and you know all about digging trenches from your days in the army. I'm sorry if this brings up painful memories, I add. No, it's no biggie. He leads me into the kitchen and sets about making coffee. There's a lot of variables about digging a trench or a grave, I suppose. The depth, composition of the ground, number of men digging, equipment being used. The motivation level of your troops is also important. Everybody likes to hunker down in a trench. Nobody likes to dig them. So where are you digging this grave? Redigging a grave. It was dug with a backhoe and then dug up again in the middle of the night, I say. Really? He asks. My mom, I stifle a tear. It's not the time for tears. I have a crime to solve. That's horrible, Jonathan says. Is she okay? I look at him doubtfully. Maybe he's not as sharp as I believed. I mean, other than the fact that she's passed, is everything okay? He corrects himself. They didn't desecrate the body? No, only stole her jewelry, I answer. Let me think for a second, he pauses. Uprooting a fresh dug grave with one, maybe two people and shovels. That's probably less than an hour of work. An hour to dig 6 feet down. They would have to be well motivated, I say. True, he agrees, but I doubt your grave is 6 feet under. That's an old standard popularized by cowboy movies. The law states the top of the grave must be a minimum of 2 feet deep under the ground. And your perps aren't digging down to the bottom of the grave, only the top. So that's about 36 cubic feet. Maybe 40 minutes work through already broken up soil. How do you know so much about digging graves, I ask. You don't want to know, he sips his coffee. Some things are better left unsaid. His eyes have a faraway look, and I think I've triggered something painful. Thank you, I kiss his cheek. I'll show myself out. I decide to go back to the grave to look for clues. I'm sure there's nothing the police have missed, and I wouldn't know a clue if it jumped up and bit me, but I have to look. When I get to the cemetery, there's a red sports car parked in the tiny parking lot. I start among the graves, thinking it's the perpetrators returning to the scene of the crime. I've been led to believe they always do that if daytime television is any judge. I see a somewhat gangly but well-dressed woman wandering among the graves. She's wearing the same spring dress I'm wearing, only she's wearing it better. I hate that. Not only do we have the same fashion sense and shop in the same boutique, she does it better. We even have the same purse and similar tennis shoes. Excuse me, I call when I get closer. Sherry, she smiles as she turns around. I recognize the 5 o'clock shadow on his chin and the poorly done makeup. Before I can take a step back, Jock is upon me, kissing me on both cheeks while holding my arms in a grip like he's afraid I'll run in terror. It must be hard being a transvestite in a small town. There aren't any alternative discos in Richmond. We don't even have a straight dance bar. The closest thing we have is the retro radio station in the big city being played at the local nail salon. Jock, I return his hug. You haven't been practicing with the brushes. I tap the corner of his lip. An oversight, he says. I'm on staycation right now and was visiting my grandmere's grave like I do every Wednesday. I confess, not going to work and staying at home for a number of days, I lost track. I only realized it was Wednesday an hour ago. I rushed things to get here before noon. My grandmere always liked the morning best. Why are you here, Sherry? Mom's grave was plundered last night, I mumble. I don't want to explain this to every person I meet. I'm here to look for clues. Then you'll need a partner in crime solving, Jock laughs. It just so happens I have a number of days at your disposal, and I am quite good at puzzles. Not the jigsaw puzzles, but logic games. That's kind of you. I start to refuse his offer. It is not sympathy, Sherry. You're a very good person and a good friend. We don't move in the same circles, but I would be honored to help you. Plus, I drive. Peter will need the car before long, no? Do you really want to walk all over Richmond hunting clues? I guess not, I admit. Let's look at the grave. We march over to the spot. Jock stands surveying the ground while I look about. He just stands there, tapping his chin while I hunt around, looking for clues. Honestly, I have no idea what a clue would look like, what it would be, or where it would be found, so I walk back to Jock and survey the grave with him. He then moves two graves over and starts to mimic shoveling with an imaginary tool. After about 3 minutes of gardening Tai Chi, he stands back beside me and taps his chin some more. They were short, he finally says. What do you mean, I ask. Notice the way the dirt is piled beside the grave, Jock says. It forms a berm with the bulk of the dirt placed close to the hole because the person could not lift the shovel over the pile they were creating. A tall man would have been able to fling the dirt almost anywhere. This person placed it carefully to create as little disturbance as possible. Either they were short, potentially having difficulty with a long-handled shovel, or they cared for your mother very much and did not want to disturb her grave more than necessary. You're saying the perp knew my mom, I ask. Everyone knew your mom, but this grave robber took care when defiling the grave. That indicates an emotional attachment as well as a personal one. This robber liked your mom enough to be careful with her remains. Then why leave her in the open all night, I ask. The local coffee shop across the road, Jock points. It is open all night. Visitors past midnight are rare because we really are a sleepy little village. But the robber would have needed light to pull the jewelry at least, maybe not to dig up the grave if there was enough of a moon. Bending over the body to retrieve the jewels, however, they would not be able to see without a light. We should make inquiries at the coffee shop. Somebody may have seen something. We go over to the coffee shop. It's one of those big franchises that everybody loves to hate. They're everywhere, except where you need one to be when you really need a coffee. Before the coffee shop moved into town, people were dependent on gas station coffee, which is not the best at any given time. The coffee shop makes coffee all day long. It's all they do, so they get it right. The cafe is only about 400 feet away. It'll be a long shot if somebody saw something. It's early in the afternoon. I don't think we'll get lucky, but Jock also needs a cup of coffee. When we get inside, Jock starts, "If we have to play good cop, bad cop, I will be the bad cop." "Why don't I get to be the bad cop?" I ask. "You're too nice. We may need somebody who will be rough, not deny them sprinkles on a cupcake." We make our way through the line to the counter. Jock orders a cup of coffee and a donut. "Is the manager available?" he asks the cashier. "Kim," the cashier shouts. A stern-looking woman comes over and glances at us. "Is there a problem?" she asks, sounding like she won't accept any answer other than no. "Were any of your staff here today working last night between 10 and 4 in the morning?" Jock asks. "Sam, cops want to talk to you," the manager shouts at a woman hanging up her jacket after a smoke break. "Why?" Samantha asks as she sizes us up. "Take it over there." The manager nods to an empty booth in the far corner of the restaurant. We sit down on one bench. Samantha slides onto the opposite bench. "You're not cops," she snarls as she looks at us. "Why did they send social workers? I haven't violated my parole and I've got a job. It was one load of meth. Can't you get off my back?" "Exciting as that tale must be, it's not why we're here." Jock starts. "What do you want?" Samantha asks. "Last night, there was a disturbance at the graveyard across the road," Jock says. "We want to know if you saw anything." "I saw a couple of kids humping," she answers. "You saw teenagers having sex while it was dark?" Jock asks. "I saw their flashlight beam," she says. "Could you give us some details?" I ask. "I was on a smoke break," Samantha explains. "I went outside and saw a distant light in the graveyard. It wasn't very bright, but it kept flailing around wildly for about 5 minutes and then stopped and laid on the ground. I finished my smoke, and then when I came back for another cigarette an hour later, the kids had left." "Did you see these kids?" Jock asks. "No. It was too far away," she answers. "Then how do you know they were teenagers?" I ask. "Who else is going to have sex in a graveyard?" Samantha replies. Her manager glares at us. "I have to get to work. I can't afford to lose this job. She slides back out of the table and goes back to work. We didn't learn anything, I sigh.
Oh no, Sherry, we learned quite a bit, Jock replies.
The person was acting alone, trying to dig while holding a flashlight, so the light beam bounced up and down. If there had been two people, no doubt, one would have held the light while the other dug. So, if our theory is correct, we're looking for somebody short, who knew and liked my mom but was acting alone.
Correct. You see, it is not difficult. Now, all we have to do is find this person.
I know who it is, I announce. Chapter 3, The Accusation. At my suggestion, we go to Jock's place, where he puts on a business suit and washes off his makeup. Really, I don't want him in the same dress I'm wearing, especially with him wearing it better. We get back to my house just as the kids are coming in from the bus. Peter is on bereavement leave from work and happily napping with Bree on the couch. Ariel and Chet put their backpacks on the kitchen table, start to unload, and then notice the stranger sitting beside me. The air becomes thick with tension as both children realize something is wrong, but don't know what or who is at fault. I let the worry ratchet up a bit more before finally saying,
Ariel, can you go play in your room? Chet, have a seat. We need to talk, I say.
I didn't do it, Chet firmly denies, while Ariel grabs her bag and runs away.
Didn't do what, I ask.
Whatever you're blaming me for, Chet answers. What am I blaming you for, I ask.
I don't know, Chet admits. But I didn't do it.
How can you deny it if you don't know what it is, Jock asks.
All I know is it wasn't me, Chet says.
Let's start over, I suggest. Chet, last night at the graveyard, something happened.
I'm not angry, okay? I'm a little angry, but I'm more confused.
Okay, Chet starts turning the wheels in his head.
I was there, but it wasn't me.
Why did you do it, I ask.
It was a dare, but I only did it once. I didn't like it, so it wasn't me, he explains.
If you did it but didn't like it, you still did it, Jock explains.
Yeah, but it was a dare, so it doesn't count, Chet answers.
One of your friends dared you to dig up Granny Silver's grave, I ask, the anger seeping into my voice.
No, Chet answers. What are you talking about?
Granny Silver's grave was dug up last night and robbed, I say.
That's so cool, Chet smiles and then coughs. In a completely bad way, he adds.
What are you talking about, I ask again.
Nothing, Chet answers.
Chet, I growl the name out so it's longer than it should be.
Nothing. I didn't do it, he says.
Chet.
I snap his name.
I smoked a cigarette, he buckles. But it was a dare, so it doesn't count. And I didn't inhale, so it doesn't double count.
Chet, did you rob Granny's grave? I ask point blank.
No, that's gross, he answers.
Okay. You're grounded for a week, I say.
For what? He stammers.
Smoking a cigarette, I reply.
But it was a dare, he complains.
I dare you to say that again. I can see his brain trying to process what happened behind his eyes. I know my kids. He's trying to figure a way out of this while at the same time trying to see how he was caught.
You can go to your room, I announce.
Fine, he grabs his bag and storms off, slamming his bedroom door. Bree wakes up and starts to fuss.
Punishing our children is really just an inconvenient way of punishing ourselves. They can't play with their friends, go outside, or engage in extracurricular activities. That means they sit around the house glaring daggers at us.
Really, it's all about punishing Chet.
Ariel rarely screws up enough that she needs to be grounded. Chet's only good for about 2 months out of the year when school is out.
Of course, that still doesn't explain why he was in a graveyard at midnight, Jock says. Chet, I scream. It wasn't me, he shouts back. We'll pick up the investigation tomorrow, Jock shows himself out. Chapter 4, The Interview. How well do we know your mother? Jock asks over morning coffee at my house. He's dressed in a blazer, blouse, and pencil skirt that does little to hide the bulge in his groin. I can't help notice when he isn't looking. It's like an eye magnet. She was my mom, I answer as I purse my lips around my coffee mug. But how well do you know her? He asks again. Do you know her enemies, her hopes and dreams? Did you sit down and have heart-to-heart conversations with her? We did that, I say. Once, after her finding out about me being a prostitute. That was so last year, Jock replies. Have you done it lately? No, I admit. Then we need to find your mom's best friend. Do you know who that is? He asks. I think so. She had her bridge club, I answer. Fishing off the bridge or jumping into the water, he asks. Neither. The game played with cards, I explain. After coffee, we get into his car to cruise over to Hamilton Street. We go over the McBean Street Bridge. On one side is a collection of youths fishing off the bridge, despite the signs saying not to. On the other side is a group of boys braving the 12-foot fall into shallow water. Ducks scatter everywhere as the boys plummet into the water. See, it's popular. Jock continues to drive. Within minutes, we're at Megan Forsythe's house. There's a trade van parked in the driveway. Jock pulls up beside it, and then we go up and knock on the door. She opens it, sees Jock, and gets a look of concern on her face. Then she notices me. Buste. Buste Morgan, she squeals in delight. It's Jessica Silver, I tell her. Can we come in and talk? Of course, just let me finish touching up my lipstick. She pulls a tube from her purse and applies it in the hall mirror while we wait in the doorway. She's 70-some-odd years old, the same as my mom was. A man in his early 50s comes out of the kitchen into the hallway. He doesn't notice us as he's tucking in his shirt and zipping up his pants. All right, Megan, he says, and then notices us. Sorry, I didn't know you had company. The sink is fixed. It didn't take long. So 50 after the discount. Thank you, Kirk. She hands him a thin envelope from her purse. As he's squeezing past, Megan swats him on the tush. He gets in his van and drives away. There's always something wrong with the plumbing. She dabs her lips to get rid of excess lipstick. Now tell me, what can I do for you? She leads us to the living room and invites us to sit. There's coffee and cookies shortly, and then she sits down to talk. We have come on a delicate matter, Jock starts. Is he your pimp? Megan asks me, a flash of excitement in her eyes. No, he's just a friend, I answer. You'll find out soon enough, but Mom's grave was opened and plundered yesterday. Yes, I had heard, she says. It was on the local news. Grave robbing, seriously. What is this world coming to? All her jewelry was removed. Do you know who hated my mom enough to desecrate her grave? Did they take her Louboutin pumps that she was buried with? Megan asks. Her shoes, no. They left the shoes. Then it wasn't somebody who hated her. Those red-soled shoes were worth more than all her jewelry combined. They really are a wonderful pair of shoes. Clarice always said she wanted to be buried in her Georgettes. I didn't know she wanted that, I admit. She went without shoes because the funeral director said it could damage the casket. Really, she pauses. I had no idea that a fashionably dressed dead woman could cause so much damage from the inside of a coffin. Something about different degradation rates causing uneven wear, I explain. and yet they buried her with jewelry that would not corrode at all. That's interesting, Megan says. Is it? Jock asks. Well, we all kind of assumed, meaning her friends, that she would be buried without anything of value other than her shoes. The only people that knew she had on her jewels are you and the funeral director, Megan says. And anybody at the viewing, I add. Please, she smiles and taps my knee. You don't bury a woman with $1,000 worth of jewelry on her. You give that to her kids and put her in the ground with something from the dollar store. Could I have her shoes? The Louboutins? We're the same size, and I don't think she would want them thrown out. I'll think about it, I say. My mother and I were also the same shoe size. I didn't know she had a pair of Christian Louboutin pumps in her closet. It's ghoulish, but I need a new pair of power shoes for the office. It's the poop lady. A boy comes into the room and sings. You, Kelly Duncan, Megan's daughter, snarls as she sees me. Get out. Kelly, don't be rude, Megan warns. These are my friends. You know Busty and her associate, Mr. Carmichael. Megan makes up a name for Jock. They had some questions about an unfortunate incident involving Clarice Silver and her Christian Louboutin pumps. Fine, get out anyway. The plumber is coming over to fix the sink, and I don't want you blocking the driveway. I think the plumber already was blown through here. I smile and take my leave. Thank you, Megan. You've given us something to think about. Richmond doesn't have a funeral parlor. With the number of old people in town counting down the clock, you'd think we would have one, but we don't. Going to the mortuary is the next logical step, but it also means going into the city. There's nothing wrong with that either, but people in Richmond are kind of quirky. We don't like admitting that we're really just a borough of a large city and dependent on its infrastructure. After all, we have our own branch of the library and fire department, which belong to the city. We stop by Jock's place so he can change into a better outfit. We pull into his driveway, and there's a black sports car in the laneway. The door to his house is slightly ajar, and his face turns a little sour. Nuts, he complains. I'm sorry, Sherry. In the excitement of our investigation, I forgot I had a date with Brandon, and I'm supposed to be wearing the slacks. You'll have to continue without me, I'm afraid. The bus has left for the morning, and Peter has our car, I sigh. It'll wait until tomorrow. Nonsense. We must write this injustice to Madam Silver. Take my car. You've driven stick before. A woman, drawn by the sounds of our voices, comes out of the house. She is breathtaking in her outfit and makeup. It isn't until she gets a little closer that it's noticeable her shoulders are a bit too square and her hips too narrow. Unlike Jock, Brandon has been practicing and is well put together. In Jock's defense, clothing selection is slightly easier than makeup. Busta, Brandon says in a slightly raised octave, trying to sound more feminine. Good day, my name is Antoinette. I am the cousin, I play along. A pleasant surprise, Brandon smiles like a cat spotting a mouse. Will you be joining us? Only for lunch, I smile back and get out of the car. My cousin will explain how I detained them, and it is not their fault. In exchange, I will make you lunch to apologize for the interruption. Jock and Brandon start to talk in the driveway while I get into the kitchen and start to make some sandwiches. There's some leftover turkey in the fridge that passes the sniff test. I do my best not to look at the erotica Jock has scattered about his house, pictures, figurines, the cookie jar, but it's hard as almost every surface has a doily with erotic art. It's like a really repressed granny decorated the house. That gets me thinking about my mom, and I realize I have to clean out her house. Crap. Literally, there will be cartloads of crap to get rid of. I was hoping to stage the house this coming weekend, so I'd better put my sleuthing on hold. I've got to go, I announce as the couple walks into the house. Soup is simmering in the pot, and there are sandwiches. I have to clear out Mom's house before the weekend, so our mission will have to wait. Chapter 5. The House. The door of Mom's house is slightly ajar when I get there. A smart woman would get out her cell phone, call the cops, and then observe from a safe distance. I barge into the house, intent on catching the perpetrators in the process. Instead, I hear records wobbling on Mom's old record player and mostly older women milling about being overseen by Chet and Ariel, who are wandering over the house. This is not what I expected. Peter comes out of the bathroom, wiping his hands on his slacks. He looks up, sees me, and smiles. "Caught," he shouts. Everybody pauses and looks a little sheepish. "What is going on?" I ask. "We're cleaning out your mom's house," Peter answers. "I took a couple of days off to help with getting her things in order. I know you wanted to stage the house this week, but you were preoccupied with your mission, so I grabbed the kids and we started cleaning. Word spread and, volunteers showed up." "Volunteers," I reply. "They're looking for shoes," Chet answers. "Jessica, darling, Sylvia Hopkins from Mom's Bridge Club comes over. Where's the safe? I'm sure the Louboutins would be in there." "Mom didn't have a safe," I answer, while at the same time being astonished by the woman's gall. "Don't be silly. She always said she kept the Louboutin pumps in her safe," Sylvia says. "Safe place, maybe," Peter suggests. "I think you should leave," I tell Sylvia and then raise my voice. "I think you should all leave." "Jessica," Peter soothes. "The kids and I are making sure nothing really valuable gets taken. Most of this stuff was going to charity, so why not let them take some of this junk? It's really helping out. Nobody but these women want 30-year-old outfits." "Mom didn't own any clothes older than 5 years," I retort. "Yes, she was a grandma, but realistically, we have to clear the house quick. I don't think many people are going to want 60-year-old records," Peter says. "There's the Beatles and Stones in there, in mint condition," I complain. "Which is why we've put the good ones to the side," Peter continues as if I hadn't interrupted. "If you want help, we've got help. If you want to do everything yourself, you're not staging this weekend. We're all just trying to help. Dad told me to keep my eye on the prize." Ariel comes into the room and pipes up. "I'll go start on the kitchen cutlery. I must have looked confused." "It's Dad's advice," Chet adds. "I told her to have a sense of perspective and go after what she wants in life," Peter explains. "I told her life is fleeting and you only get one spin round. Your mom knew that. I think she would want her friends to benefit from her eclectic collection of junk." "Peter, can I have this electric frying pan?" a woman calls from the kitchen. "Sure thing," he calls back. "That's Mom's frying pan," I stammer. "And Clarice doesn't need it anymore, and the no-stick coating is peeling off. It was going in the garbage anyway. Do you want our help or not?" "Okay," I answer. I hang out for about an hour to make sure they're doing a good job. I trust my family, but none of them is an appraiser like I am. That is to say, after growing up in that house, I know what things are worth. Truthfully, I would have liked to go through the house first and pick out the stuff of sentimental value, but it's just stuff. I don't have room for it at my house. I have crap of my own. "Just don't let them take the rest of Mom's jewelry," I order as I'm getting ready to leave. "There aren't any other jewels," Peter answers. I stop in my tracks. "What do you mean? Mom had a ton of jewelry, all of it quite valuable," I say. "There's nothing like that here," Peter repeats. I do a quick run around the house. There's no jewelry except a couple of pieces in the bedroom. "I helped Mom pick out her jewelry all the time," I start to cry. "She had a huge toolbox full of gold and silver and jewels. Her last outfit was on her dresser when she died, so that's what I buried her in. It's all connected, I have a flash of insight. The jewelry in the grave completed the set, so the robber had to dig it up. They came here, got the toolbox, and then dug up the body for the rest. I have to find that toolbox. I saw Harry Randall leaving with some toolboxes, Chet announces. I checked them all except one. They had Grandpa's old tools. Most of the tools were rusted and dull, so I let him take them. What was in the other toolbox, I ask. I don't know, Chet admits. More tools, I thought. How many toolboxes, I ask.
Six, Chet answers.
Six, I clarify. He made two trips to his car, Chet adds. We'll talk about this later, I state.
I didn't do it, Chet answers.
What didn't you do, I ask.
Whatever you think I did, Chet says.
Harry Randall lives with his parents in the posh neighborhood of Upper Channon House. That isn't the real name of the street. It's Channon House Crescent, but there is a distinct gap in income between one end of the street and the other as clear as a set of train tracks running through the middle. I knock on the Randall door.
Laura Randall, Harry's mother, opens the door.
We know each other as I had babysat Harry when I was in my early 20s and he was 10. Laura was about 40. I get ready for an uncomfortable conversation, but Laura beats me there.
You're here about the toolboxes, she asks.
Yes, I admit.
You should be ashamed, Laura says.
I should be ashamed because your son stole my mom's jewelry, I ask.
Harry, she shouts over her shoulder.
Bring those boxes here.
Mom, he calls back.
Bring them, she shouts.
Oh, Harry comes into the hallway, pushing a cart loaded with five toolboxes.
Where's the sixth one, I ask.
Yes, Harry, his mother sneers. Where is the sixth one?
I didn't think you wanted to see that one, he answers.
These are my dad's tools. I quickly peek into the other boxes.
He can keep them.
I'm only interested in the jewelry.
You have an odd idea of jewels, Laura says as Harry carries over the sixth box and puts it on the cart.
I tip it open. Inside is not jewelry. I pull out a latex rope with knurled bumps and a handle on it.
What is that? Laura asks.
Anal beads, Harry and I say at the same time.
We look at each other.
What were you going to do with those anal beads, Harry? Laura demands.
I was going to shove them up my girlfriend's ass when we were having sex, he admits.
Apparently, if you pull them out at the point of orgasm, it makes it that much stronger, I add.
You can have these, I hand him the beads.
He most certainly cannot. Laura swats Harry's hand away from the toy.
What else is in the box?
What isn't in the box?
It's a large toolbox full of sex toys, vibrators, dildos, nipple clamps, and more anal beads. Plus, there are a lot of pornographic magazines that are 10 years out of print. The final two things are all the instruction and cleaning manuals for all the toys and a small tin box that, when opened, is full of weed.
I don't need any of this, I shove the box toward Harry. It's yours.
Have fun.
It is not his, Laura says.
It's not mine, I reply. Mom is dead and Dad's in a retirement home. I honestly didn't know there was a box of sex toys in their house. I was looking for a toolbox full of jewelry.
What will my neighbors think? Laura questions.
Are you planning on telling them your son brought home a box of pilfered sex toys? I reach into the box to pull out a vibrator with a rabbit ear clitoral stimulator.
Here, I hand it to her.
I'm not going to tell anybody about this. Go have some fun. Maybe it'll shake loose that stick up your ass. I turn and walk away.
I can think of two possibilities as I get into Jock's car. Mom had a secret stash of sex toys hidden in the basement with Dad's tools, or Dad had a secret stash of sex toys he took on work calls with him. He worked in trades as a handyman for most of his life.
He did some carpentry, some plumbing, laid floors, and apparently, laid wives other than his.
I'm not going to talk about it.
He's happy at the retirement home.
I see no reason to bring up that he's some sort of sex maniac. My cell phone rings in my purse as I get to Jock's car. Hello, I speak into the receiver.
Mrs. Silver, this is Mr. Douglas at the Farquhary Funeral Home.
There has been an irregularity with your mother's account. Do you think you could come by to talk?
I was heading there next, I mention.
I'll see you in 30 minutes. That's the thing about Richmond.
It has good access to the highway, so it's 30 minutes to anywhere in the city. It takes about 11 minutes to get to the highway, but from there across the big city is 20 minutes tops. Assuming the traffic gods smile on me. When I get to the funeral home, it occurs to me how ghoulish the name is. Funeral home. It's not home.
It's not where I want to be. Funeral parlor isn't much better.
A man is waiting on the steps of the old, Victorian-style house.
Are you Mrs. Silver? He asks.
Yes, Mr. Douglas. Welcome to our funeral establishment and charnel house, Mrs. Silver. I am sorry for your loss.
Thank you, I reply. What seems to be the problem with my mom, I mean, other than she's passed.
Please, he waves a hand inside the building. My office is down the hall on the right. It's more comfortable for conversation than the front steps. I let him lead to the office. Once inside, he waves me to a leather banker's chair and sits in a similar one. The office is nicely appointed but sparse. There are china teacups for coffee, crystal decanters for water. Being dead apparently pays well.
I'm very sorry for your loss, Mr. Douglas repeats. Thank you, I reply. What seems to be the problem?
When your mother's grave was dug and the burial completed, some items went missing, he says.
And I ask,
well, those items were not your mother's, Mr. Douglas explains in an unctuous voice.
Excuse me, I ask.
Clarice Silver paid for everything in advance, as is the custom these days, but we didn't get the jewelry she wanted to be buried with.
I left several messages at your residence with a gentleman named Chester.
Chet, I curse.
Yes, Chet.
He seems a lively fellow. Anyway, Chet appears not to have given you the messages, so we adorned Mrs. Silver with some of our jewelry with the intent of retrieving it between the viewing and the lowering of the casket.
That didn't happen due to a personal crisis on the part of one of our staff. So, the jewels were buried with Clarice, and to put it delicately, we would like you to pay for them. Chet took that message as well. He was quite shirty about it, actually.
This is instead of digging my mom up and taking them, correct, I ask.
That would be horrific, Mr. Douglas says.
But it has already happened, I say.
What? He gasps.
2 nights ago, someone dug up the grave of my mother and took all her jewelry.
Your jewelry.
Then we have a problem. His unctuous tone dips ever so slightly.
You can claim it on your insurance, I reply.
I'm investigating the crime now and we'll be getting a report for the insurance later this week.
You're investigating the crime, he scoffs. I did not realize you were a member of the constabulary.
I'm not, I admit. The police said it wasn't important enough for them to get involved.
Did somebody hate your mom that badly that they defiled her corpse? He asks.
Nobody hated my, I start to say, but at the same time realize who the culprit is.
I have to go, Mr. Douglas. I think my plans for the weekend have changed. I'll send you a copy of the report for your insurance.
It's not that easy. Those were priceless pieces, he explains.
You don't put priceless jewelry on a dead body going into the ground, I answer. There's something you're not telling me.
It was my wife's jewels, and they've been kind of written off before. I need them back. Enjoy your fraud, I say as I leave.
Chapter 6, The Smiths.
You want to do what this weekend? Peter asks. I want to go visit your parents, I answer.
I thought you were going to stage your mom's house, he says.
It can wait. We still have to clean it out. It'll be next weekend before it's ready for staging. We'll take the kids and make an outing of it. The house wasn't ready for staging by any stretch of the imagination.
Take us where? Ariel asks as she and Chet walk into the kitchen.
To see your grandparents, I answer.
I love visiting Papa Silver, Ariel smiles.
Yeah, Chet agrees.
No, your dad's parents, I correct.
Oh, they both say at the same time.
What's wrong, I ask, all the while knowing the answer.
They, Ariel starts.
They don't like us and only want to know where we are so they can harvest our kidneys, Chet explains.
I heard Grandma Smith say that once.
She did not, I laugh half-heartedly.
It's true.
I had heard the comment, though didn't think the kids had.
Why are we going there? Ariel asks.
They haven't seen Bree yet, I grasp at a reasonable excuse.
They've seen pictures and videos, Peter replies.
Social media doesn't count, I answer.
We're going this weekend, he clarifies.
Yes, we are visiting your parents this weekend.
I'll see if Uncle Chet can show up too, Peter suggests.
Yeah, both kids squeal.
No, I countermand. Uncle Chet is fun, but this is a chance to bury the hatchet with your parents.
I don't need an expense account to do that. Uncle Chet is fun and rich beyond belief. He owns several potato chip factories, not big brand names, but the swanky artisan small batch kind that people gladly pay $7 a bag for because the chips are artisanal.
I don't get it personally, but Chet Sr. is also my boss, sort of.
He put me through school and offered me a job as a marketing executive once I'm ready to go back to work after having Bree. Uncle Chet loves Bree. He loves all his nieces and nephews, but Bree the most because she's a baby.
He doesn't pay favorites, but does play favorites.
It's settled, I state. We're visiting Grandma and Grandpa this weekend. You will all behave, and we'll turn their frown upside down.
Maybe I should stay home, Chet suggests.
I'm old enough to stay by myself.
I can be good.
He can't be good, Peter says while looking at Chet.
I'll stay with him. We can have male bonding time.
We're all going, I order. The weekend is coming, so we're going as a darn family. Deal with it however you have to, but we're going.
The truth is, I don't want to go by myself. It seems likely that the only people with a grudge against my mom are the in-laws. How exactly that translates into digging up her body and stealing jewelry, I'm not sure, but they're my best bet.
To be honest, I'm pretty sure Roger and Betty Smith hate me. Maybe not Roger so much, but Betty despises me with the passion of 1,000 burning suns, so Roger isn't on it by default. The reason she hates me is because I took her baby away. It's the classic, mom hates the new affection figure. Kind of a reverse Oedipus thing if I understood any of the psychology I took in college the second time around. There's a thick air of angst around the dinner table that evening. I can feel each member of my family locked in their personal misery about visiting the Smiths. The only one happy is Bree, and she's blowing spit bubbles. I snuggle in beside Peter for bed after the kids have gone to sleep. Bree is in her crib at the far end of our room. We really need a bigger house. Ariel says she's fine sharing her room with Bree when Bree is a little older, but I'd like each of the kids to have their own room. That way, when they piss each other off, there's somewhere for them to go to get away from each other.
Do we really want to go to my parents' house? Peter asks as he puts away his glasses.
No, I admit. But it's been long enough that we've been ostracized.
And, he asks, I need to talk to them. I know they didn't like my mom for the simple reason of bringing me into the world to take you away from them. I need to know they didn't have anything to do with the grave robbing.
We're driving an hour to accuse my parents of grave robbing?
Jess, that's not a good idea. They didn't do it.
How do you know? I ask.
My dad has a bad back, and mom has never touched a shovel in her life. All traveling there is going to do is make the neglect worse. Do you want that?
We're going, I insist.
All right, he puts his arm around me and draws me in. Friday morning has the police report pop into my email. It is the amended report indicating the jewelry was from a third party. There is a note from the detective stating that he appreciated my honesty, and they'll keep the case open should anything new develop, but there is little they can do. I find solace in the bottom of an ice cream tub. As I scan the report, I notice something about the clues they found. One pair of footprints came into the gravesite after the body had been dug up. They know because the work boots that made the print trod on the upturned soil. The footprints appeared to have walked to the grave, stood, and then turned around.
Plans, Peter asks from the kitchen table.
It's a long shot, but I'm going to visit my dad, I answer.
Oh, he asks.
Somebody stood reverently at the grave after it had been opened. That person was wearing size 11 work boots, the same as my dad always wears. It's a long shot, but there's a couple of other things I'd like to talk about with him. Pleasant Acres of Richmond is the retirement home my dad lives in. I suppose it's fairly pleasant, and it does occupy several acres, and it's in Richmond. It's what he could afford. He was having some difficulty, and we moved him there, but Mom wanted to stay in the house. She had all her faculties, so it seemed the best option. They saw each other every day, and then less and less as my dad started to forget things. 3 months after moving to the home, rapid onset Alzheimer's claimed my dad. A month later, Mom died of a broken heart. He still recognizes me, most of the time, but nobody else. The kids haven't been to see him since his diagnosis, and they are unaware that my dad is, plainly speaking, screwy in the noodle. It hurts a lot, and I know one day he won't recognize me either.
Jess, he smiles when I walk into his room.
Hi, Dad, I smile back.
What can I do for you? He asks.
Mom died. I thought you should know, I say.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Were you too close? He asks.
Yeah, I answer as I notice a dull sheen in his eye. You do know who I am, right?
You're Jess, he replies. How do I know you?
I'm your daughter.
Oh!
Then when you say Mom died, you mean, he pauses. My wife.
Yes, I answer.
I'm sorry to hear that. How do I know you again, Jess?
It's okay, I say. I'm just a friend. Would you like me to read to you?
Sure, he hands me a book.
A rather racy book. I know my dad no longer recognizes me, but that doesn't make reading soft porn to him any easier. After an hour, I look over to see him contentedly asleep. I mark the page in the book and get up. I check in with the nurse on the way out. Mrs. Silver, a doctor, walks up to me. He's young, and this is probably his first job out of medical residency. I'm afraid your father's condition isn't well, and he's quite disruptive on the floor. I would like to move him to the security ward.
What do you mean? I ask.
He gets out, the doctor says. I'm not sure how, but I think he picks the locks and he's indiscreet.
Indiscreet, I ask.
How do I put this? The doctor glances at the desk nurse. He asks for blowjobs from pretty much everyone, the nurse smiles. Some of our tenants are happy to oblige, even though we try to curb that sort of behavior.
So, sex among the residents is bad, I clarify.
It's more the escaping thing, the doctor assures me. Last week, he unlocked the emergency exits by putting some tin foil in the microwave, the nurse explains. The thing smoked up like a chimney and set off the fire alarm. The exits automatically unlock. It took 6 hours to find him. We located him on Hamilton Street, missing his pants.
Dad, I mutter. So, do we have your permission to move him to a more secure ward? The doctor asks.
Maybe I should bring him home, I suggest. I wouldn't advise it, the doctor says.
He's a handful, the nurse adds. A week ago, some children were visiting their grandparents, and he promised the kids $1 for each pair of women's panties they brought to his room.
I hadn't heard that, I admit.
It's not something we make common knowledge, the doctor responds.
He shelled out $30, the nurse adds.
Is there anything else I should know, I ask.
He masturbates in the common areas, the doctor blushes.
Only when he can't find a partner, the nurse says. That's pretty rare. He's popular with the ladies.
I could have happily spent the rest of my life not hearing this, I admit.
Then, things click. What day did you find him on Hamilton Street?
Yesterday morning, Thursday, the doctor says.
Had he been to the small graveyard in town, I ask.
No idea, the doctor answers.
Was he wearing his work boots, I ask.
He always wears his work boots, the nurse answers. It's kind of his thing. He runs around the building fixing things.
He was a handyman, I answer.
He fixes things with a plastic fork, the doctor adds. We won't give him real tools. Not that it stopped him.
Did he say anything, I ask?
Thursday, he said Clarice didn't have her fancy shoes, and they must be in the safe, the doctor answers.
Thank you, I smile.
Can we move him to the security ward? He asks.
What are my options? I respond.
We move him to security, or you take him home, the doctor answers.
So, I don't really have options, I say.
Move him for now, and I'll see what I can do about finding him another place.
I take my leave and go to the car.
As I'm getting into my car, I see my father sneaking among the bushes beside the parking lot, being followed by two elderly women. All three are in pajamas, and they disappear among the bushes. This is the sort of thing I should flag to the staff, but at the same time, it's probably Dad's last escapade before going to the wacko ward. My father is a hound. I drive away to the sounds of giggles and moans. The case is going nowhere until Saturday. Saturday rolls around with a feeling of dread. Everyone is slow getting out of bed. It had been my intention to leave the house at 8 o'clock, get there by 9, visit a couple of hours, and be gone before lunch so we wouldn't have to sit through a meal. Now we're not going to get there until about 10:30, so we're pretty much obliged to sit through soup and sandwiches. Peter drives, which is good because I'm too flustered to think about which exit to take off the highway. I'm trying to decide what would be the best approach to accusing my mother-in-law of stealing jewelry from my mom's corpse. It's got to be tactful yet direct.
Jessica, Betty Smith hugs me at arm's length 45 minutes later.
You've almost lost all your baby weight.
What did you gain? 50 pounds.
Pumpkin, Roger Smith gives me a peck on the cheek, but at least he's smiling. More of a smirk, really, but friendly at least.
Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. This is Bree. Peter holds up the car seat for them to inspect.
She's lovely, Betty replies.
She does smell like cheese, Roger adds.
It's time to change her. I look about for a surface to change the diaper. There's nowhere comfortable. The living room furniture is encased in plastic. The dining room table looks to have been already set for lunch, unfortunately, and there's no bench in the hall.
Follow me, Pumpkin, Roger offers. I follow him to the back of the house, carrying my daughter and the diaper bag.
Roger has called me Pumpkin from the first day I met him. It drives me nuts, but I assume it's because his family is so large. He assigns generic nicknames to people to keep them straight.
Chet, I hear Betty greet my son with a warning sound in her voice. Roger leads me to a guest room that looks like it has never seen a visitor.
It is clean, remarkably clean, and there is no personality. There are no pictures, no colorful throws on the bed. The whole room screams that a guest is welcome to sleep, but not welcome to stay.
I take out the changing blanket, put it on the bed, and then proceed to do the work. Once in a clean diaper, I put the dirty one in a pouch on the diaper bag.
"Do you want to hold her?" I ask Roger.
"It's been a while since I held a baby," he admits.
"Like what?"
"2 weeks," I ask. "You've got a big family."
"I do like babies," he admits and takes Bree, and then proceeds to nibble her cheeks. She squeals in delight.
We walk back to the front hall to find everyone else in the living room, seated uncomfortably on the plastic-wrapped furniture. Roger sits on the couch with Betty, making no notion to give up Bree. Peter is sitting in an armchair facing the couch while the kids squat on the floor. That leaves me the remaining armchair. It is out of place, beaten and torn, and without plastic. I sit and immediately jump back up as the chair yelps.
"Watch the dog, Pumpkin," Roger offers as I look to see a small white dog I had mistaken as a throw pillow.
"That's Conrad's chair," Betty says as I motion for the dog to leave.
"He's a Lhasa Apso," Chet interjects unhelpfully.
"They don't shed much," Roger adds as he pats the seat beside him on the couch. The wall behind the couch is festooned with family photos. It takes me a moment to locate my crew in the bottom corner. I dig in my purse and pull out the new 8x10 with Bree.
"I brought you an update," I hand the photo to Roger, who looks at it one-handed while holding my daughter.
"That's the same dress," Betty checks the photo against the one on the wall.
"I was trying for continuity," I answer.
"That's good, dear.
There's no need to look nice all the time," Betty says.
"I like your baby," Roger tries to defuse the bomb that's already ticking.
"So nice of you to come by unannounced," Betty adds.
"I sent you an email saying we were going to come over," I reply.
"Oh yes, I got that, but the timing on it said you would be here at 9, not 11.
I think it's all the reliance young people have on their cell phones. They can't read a clock anymore.
"Kids, do you want to take Conrad for a walk?" I ask.
Betty glares like I suggested they use the tiny dog as a football.
"I'll go with them," Peter suggests.
Betty visibly relaxes, but still looks skeptically at Chet.
Within minutes, my family is gone.
Peter has extracted Bree from his father and put her in her carry pack. Leash in hand, dog on leash, and children in tow, Peter leaves with a better you than me smile on his lips. He kisses me on the cheek and whispers, "Good luck," and then leaves for the dog walk.
"Now, Pumpkin, what's going on?" Roger asks.
"I don't know how to start," I admit.
"Just spit it out," Roger suggests.
"Do you need money to buy a new wardrobe?" Betty asks.
"Did either of you dig up my mom's corpse and steal her jewelry?" I blurt out.
They stare at me blankly for a few seconds.
"Are you asking if we're grave robbers?" Roger finally breaks the silence.
"Yeah, I admit. Did you do it?"
"No," Roger says while Betty's eye starts to twitch.
"Why would you even ask us?"
"I'm running out of suspects," I confess.
"How did we even get on the list, Pumpkin? Not that I'm not flattered, but seriously, why are we suspects?"
"You don't like me," I explain. "You didn't like my mom or my family by extension. It's the kind of spiteful thing I would expect from somebody who held a grudge."
"Oh," Roger says.
Betty's mouth moves up and down like she's trying to talk, but there is no sound coming out. Instead, she looks like a fish gulping for air, all the while her face is getting redder and redder. How dare you? She finally screeches in an ear-splitting howl.
That's not exactly a denial, I say.
Get out!
Betty screams. After everything you've put our family through, now you pull this cockamamie idea out to scandalize us further.
What, exactly, have I put you through? I ask in a calm voice.
Again, Betty puckers like a fish before finally getting the words out.
The prostitution thing. That scandal lasted months.
You stole my son out of college without being productive yourself and then got Chet Sr. to pay for your late-in-life schooling and your debts.
And?
First of all, I cut her off with acid in my voice. I didn't steal Peter.
We dated, liked each other, and got married. We had kids. Life got in the way of what I planned on doing.
I've got no complaints, but I didn't steal your son because he's his own fucking person.
You don't own him.
He was never yours to steal from.
Secondly, as for Chet Sr., that's between him and me, and does not translate to you in any way.
It's none of your fucking business, you busybody nosy priss.
I immediately regret the words, but it felt so good to say them, and I'm not going to take them back.
Dog is walked, Peter comes back with the kids.
We're leaving, I announce.
So soon, Peter sounds a little shocked, yet relieved at the same time.
Yeah, most of us are not welcome here. You can stay, probably.
And Bree too, maybe Ariel.
Chet does the math in his head.
I didn't do it, Chet announces.
Not now, Chet, I warn.
I take a step toward the door, and there is a yelp from my foot.
I accidentally stepped on the barest tip of the dog's tail as it sat on the floor waiting to be released from its collar.
You don't have to leave, Betty says, though there is no warmth in her eyes.
Thank you, but we'll be going, Peter answers.
Thank you, Ariel adds politely.
Yes, fuck you very much, I say, turn on my heels, and walk out the door.
We get in the car.
Peter straps in Bree and then slides behind the wheel while I'm already trying to figure out where this situation went wrong. The car glides out of the driveway, and we all wave to Peter's parents standing on the stoop. Nobody notices, or at least mentions, I only use a finger in my waving.
How did it go? Peter asks a few minutes later as we approach the freeway ramp.
As well as can be expected, I answer.
That's good, he says.
I wouldn't make any Christmas plans for the next decade, I advise.
Are we going to see Grandma and Grandpa again? Ariel asks.
I'm sure they'll come to your wedding, I answer.
Chet, you might get a gift at yours.
What did I do? Chet asks.
You're guilty by association. Don't plan on seeing them anytime soon, I say.
That's unfortunate. I see Chet smile in the passenger side mirror.
I can't help but smile either.
At least I won't be called Pumpkin for the rest of my life.
Why does he call you Pumpkin anyway? Ariel asks.
I don't know, I admit.
It's the nursery rhyme, my husband answers.
What nursery rhyme? I ask.
You know, the one with Peter.
Peter, Peter, pumpkin eater, Chet recites.
I don't get it.
I don't either, Ariel adds.
Really?
16 years of a nickname for a lewd joke, I complain.
Uh-huh, Peter smirks.
Still don't get it, Chet calls.
Don't worry about it, I sigh.
Let's get some fast food and call it a day.
Chapter 7. The Pawn Shop.
I'm pretty much at a dead end. All my investigative prowess has done is forever ruin my relationship with Peter's parents, stir up the local community so now everybody is talking and looking for both jewelry and shoes, and cause my family further embarrassment.
Mom is dead and Dad is beyond caring, so really, I've only caused myself embarrassment.
I don't care. I am still living down my short career as a call girl. Sunday finds me in the kitchen drowning my sorrows with a spoon in a tub of ice cream. I normally don't advocate for eating to calm my emotions, but I'm really low, and it's chocolate ripple. I search my vast collection of television detective shows for a clue as to where to go next. I suddenly realize I had overlooked the obvious choice, the local pawn shop. Richmond, very briefly, had a pawn and head shop. They took whatever they thought they could sell and also sold novelty drug paraphernalia like bongs and roach clips. It didn't last long because, quite frankly, Richmond is a small town laced so tight that if it dropped a dollar, it would split its seams, straining to pick it up. Like all small towns, it's the surface that is important. The seedy underside is the underside and not publicly acknowledged. I'm not saying the head shop was run out of town, but they never turned a profit and eventually packed up and moved to the next borough over. I put away the ice cream and got the car keys. The thief would have had to fence the jewelry, and I think they were probably lazy, so I didn't expect that they would go farther than they had to. I'm slipping on my shoes when Ariel walks into the kitchen. "Where are you going?" she asks. "The thrift store," I answer. When the pawn shop left Richmond, it decided to upscale its image and refit as a thrift store. It's exactly the same, but more respectable from the outside. "Can I come?" Ariel asks. "I guess. It's going to be boring," I say. "What are you looking for?" she asks. "Clues," I answer. "I love board games," she replies. "That's one of my favorites." "Honey, never mind." Get in the car, I snag the keys as Ariel slips on her shoes. I mentioned that Richmond is 20 minutes from anywhere. It took about 15 minutes through cow-laden pastures to get to the next village outside the city. The thrift store is in a small strip mall, big by village standards, but really full of stores selling out-of-date ideas in a low-rent opportunity. "What are you looking for?" I ask Ariel. "A winter glamour in white Barbie doll," she says with a deadpan face. "Really, here?" I ask. "Only 15 were produced in 2006. As far as I know, not all of them are accounted for. The missing dolls have to be somewhere. Why not here?" "Do you have the $2,000 one would cost? She doesn't have that much in her account, but she could be close." Ariel is very good with her money, having bought her own cell phone and maintaining her own plan for 2 years. That was one of the things with my mom. She had signed for Ariel's cell phone, which ultimately saved me from prison, so they both got a pass. "No," she admits as we pull into the parking lot. "If it's here, then they probably don't know how much it's worth. I'm betting I can get it for $20 if they have one." We get out of the car and go into the thrift store. It's pretty much like every seedy pawn shop seen in movies or television. There's a display full of expensive-looking watches and electronics, row after row of merchandise without any rhyme or reason, and then the really expensive or potentially dangerous items behind the counter at the back of the dimly lit room. Looking for something in particular, a youth behind the counter calls. Youth is probably not the right term. He's probably at least 21, but looks about 16. He has that thin, teenage lip fuzz that boys think marks them as men. "I'm looking for some jewelry," I answer as the bell over the door announces another customer. "We've got all sorts," the kid waves his hands over the glass display counter. "All sorts of crap, really. It is jewelry, but if there are any actual jewels in there, I'd eat my shoes. I'd eat my mom's shoes if I could find them." "Do you have any dolls?" Ariel asks. "Over there," the clerk points his chin toward a corner of the shop. "That's where you'll find toys, sports equipment, dolls, and action figures." The shop bell rings as another customer enters the store. The clerk gives me a brief once-over to judge whether or not I'm interested in the jewelry and then moves to the new client. He figures I'm not buying. He's right.
Can I help you, sir? The clerk asks.
Yes, the scruffy-looking man replies. Give me all the money in the register.
There's a gun in his hand, and he's pointing it at the clerk.
Sure, the clerk stays cool.
Keep your hands where I can see them, the robber barks.
No problem. Just stay calm, the clerk says, as if this is any other afternoon. For all I know it is.
You, the thief swings around to point the gun at me. Give me all your money.
Okay, I answer.
Just don't hurt anybody.
We don't want any trouble.
Who's we? He demands.
My daughter and I answer. Give me your fucking purse or I'll kill the little bitch.
Something inside me snaps. I have never called my daughter a bitch or let anybody else do so, and I'm not about to start now. I begin to hand over my purse, but at the last second, swing it into his hand like a club. It doesn't have much impact, but enough to throw his arm up so he can't shoot me if he pulls the trigger.
What does have a significant impact is my foot landing with full force from a wind-up kick into his nutsack. He drops the gun and doubles over. I grab him by the back of his shirt and then throw him down to the floor. I grab the gun as I stand above him. I smash another foot into his groin from behind, then kneel down on top of him and press my knee into the small of his back. I place the gun barrel against the back of his neck. I've never fired a gun before. I don't even know how to. All I know, from television and movies, is that if I pull the trigger, he'll die in a spectacularly messy fashion. I keep my finger well away from the trigger, but don't let him know that.
You so much as fart, and I'll blow your head off, I say.
Call the cops, I tell the clerk. The police come in record time. I'm asked to give a report to an officer. The report explains why I was at the pawn shop in the first place. Ariel patiently waits, but listens to everything. When the report is done, she looks like she's about to cry.
What's wrong, honey? I crouch down to her level so we're eye to eye.
We were almost killed. She starts to cry. The adrenaline left my body, and I feel like shit.
Oh, honey, I pause.
She's right. I can't say I had the situation under control because clearly I didn't. I can't say it'll be all right because clearly it's not. She looks at me with a quivering eye, hoping that I will say something that will make it better.
Death comes for everyone, I finally say. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not for 80 years, but eventually everyone dies. It's not how we die that defines us. It's how we live, the legacy we leave behind, and how we are remembered.
That's a bumper sticker, she smiles, but at least she smiles.
Let's go home, I suggest.
Let's go to Grandma's, she counters. There's something you should check out.
What, I ask?
Her safe. Chapter 8, The Confession.
We drive to Mom's house in silence. Ariel seems okay but shaken, me too. When we get there, Peter is clearing away the last few things with Chet. Most of the stuff is supposed to go to an estate auction, but as was explained to me, there is little of value.
What's up? Peter asks.
I don't know, I admit. Ariel has something to show us.
It's in the master bedroom, Ariel says. We all march upstairs to what's left of the master suite. There are a couple of dressers and a bed frame. The mattress and box spring went to the curb, but the frame is still in good shape. Ariel steps over the frame and then sticks her finger through a knot hole in a floorboard. She pulls 4 feet of board to swivel up on a hinge.
Granny's safe, Ariel explains. Inside the safe are the toolbox she used for jewelry, a pair of high heel shoes with the classic red sole of Christian Louboutin, and a small velvet bag.
Well, we found her jewelry and shoes. Peter pulls out the tool chest and pumps.
What is this? He holds the velvet bag, then hands it to me. I spill the contents into my hand. It's the jewelry Mom was buried in. The jewels from the funeral home.
The ones that were missing. How did those get here? Peter asks.
I have no idea, I admit. Chet.
It wasn't me, he looks at his sister.
Ariel, I ask.
I put them there, Ariel says with a glum face.
You dug up Granny, pulled the jewelry off her, and then walked over here to hide it under a floorboard. Why?
I got a phone call on Wednesday night after you had gone to bed. It was Grandpa. He said he needed some help because he didn't have much time and he was worried about us. I met him at the graveyard with a shovel and then dug up Granny to get the jewelry.
Why would you do that? Peter stammers.
Grandpa said we were running out of money. We could sell the jewelry and it would be enough to take care of us. He didn't have enough of a... What was the word you used, Mom? Legacy?
He didn't have enough of a legacy to leave us with the cost of the retirement home.
It sounds like one of his lucid moments, except for the digging up a body, I say.
After we got the jewels, he took off his pants and ran away in his boxer shorts, Ariel continues. I couldn't keep up with him, so I came here to put the jewels in Granny's safe and then went home.
That was about 3 in the morning. Why didn't you tell us any of this before, I ask.
I didn't know there was a problem, Ariel answers. I've been running around half the week trying to solve this, my voice goes up an octave.
And the first I've heard about it is when you filed the police report at the thrift store, Ariel says.
What happened at the thrift store, Peter asks. Not important.
What do you mean you didn't know what was going on? I accused your brother in the kitchen.
After sending her to her room to play, Chet interjects. The clearing of the house when we talked about jewelry, I suggest. Where she left the room moments before, and whatever you said to my parents, she was with me walking the dog, Peter responds.
So, you were never around, I look at Ariel.
I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't know what was going on, and Grandpa said he needed help because they were going to lock him in the wacko ward where he would never get out again. He wanted to keep his eye on the prize.
Why did you leave Granny uncovered? I asked.
Do you know how heavy a shovel of dirt is? Ariel asks.
I'm small, it was late, and I was tired, and I learned in school that animals won't touch a human corpse because of the embalming process.
I checked the weather app on my phone, so I knew it wasn't going to rain.
So, you decided to leave her because somebody would notice in the morning, I clarify.
Someone did, Ariel replies.
You know what you did was wrong, right? I ask. I helped Grandpa make sure his family would be looked after when he was gone and got to see him one last time before he's committed. Is that wrong? Ariel asks.
Not when you put it that way, Peter whispers.
Ariel, I build up a head of steam.
Mom, she replies.
I pause. I mentally run through the table of contents of every parenting book I've ever read, and there's nothing that leaps to mind about scolding children for grave robbing. Let's get some ice cream and discuss the difference between right and wrong.
Ice cream, both kids shout.
We pick up the toolbox of jewels, the shoes, the funeral jewelry, and Bree, who has been sleeping soundly in her car seat.
I'm thinking maybe once everything settles down, I'll write a parenting manual that's practical. Epilogue.
Another Wednesday, 3 months later, another funeral, and I still can't fart in a thong.
Dad's coffin is laid to rest beside Mom.
Ariel holds one hand, Chet the other, and Bree is nestled against Peter's chest.
It happened quicker than I thought, Peter comments. At least he went the way he wanted to go, I say.
He died of a heart attack from having sex with a nurse half his age, Peter says. I'm pretty sure that's what he wanted, I reply. Out of the corner of my eye,
I see the funeral director come to the edge of the service. I pass Chet and Ariel off to Peter.
Is there a problem, Mr. Douglas? I ask once I reach him.
First of all, Mrs. Silver, thank you for returning those lost jewels. My wife and marriage are most appreciative.
But, I ask.
There's a discrepancy in the burial of your father, he says.
A discrepancy, I ask.
He asked to be buried with this. He hands me a small wooden box. Unfortunately, that did not happen.
We'll be discounting the preparations and cutting you a check to apologize. What's in it, I ask.
No idea, he admits. I suggest you open it.
I pop the catch with some difficulty.
A handful of condoms spill to the ground, along with a vibrating cock ring, an antique pocket watch, and a letter. I pick up the letter while Mr. Douglas retrieves the watch.
There's an inscription on the back, he says as I start to scan the letter. Thank you. I take the watch and gather up the condoms as my family is starting to cross the graveyard toward me.
It's been an adventure, Mr. Douglas. Enough to last a lifetime, I'm sure.
I think about what I just read.
Not even close, I walk toward my family.
Stuff about the author.
John W. Partington is a Canadian writer living in Ottawa, Ontario. He was a soldier for 15 years in the Canadian Forces. After completing one tour of duty in Haiti, he suffered a bout of mental illness, which resulted in a medical discharge from the Canadian Forces. Since then, he has had a few jobs. Writing, however, will always be his first love. His wife is his true love. An excerpt from a treasure hunt in a small town. It all starts with a fishing derby in 1979. My dad was quite the angler in his youth and won the Richmond All Ages Fish Derby on the local river. First prize was $1,000. $1,000 in the 1970s would be worth about $10,000 by today's standards. To give you an idea, front row tickets to a major concert in Madison Square Garden were about $10. People always asked my dad, as the story was related to me because I wasn't even a glimmer in his eye at that point, what he was going to do with his windfall.
I'm going to buy apples, he'd answer.
People thought he was a fool, or a lunatic, or both. Flash forward to today, and me hunched over his grave as mourners all wander away after the service. I'm picking up condoms that fell out of a box handed to me by the funeral director. An envelope containing faded pages falls out with the condoms. I open it and read the first page. It's dated the beginning of September 1979. Dear Ryan,
thank you for investing in my company. I'll be sending your bonds by separate service once we go public, but I just wanted to welcome you to the family. It's my dream that there be an apple in every house in America one day. Your $1,000 is going to make it happen. You're taking a risk, but I think we're going to do something great together.
Steve.
What's up? Peter asks as I pore over the letter. We're going on a scavenger hunt, I answer. The kids will be happy. What are we looking for? He asks.
Buried treasure. $1,000 worth of bearer bonds from day one of Apple going public. Excuse me, Peter says. It turns out, I whisper, even though there's nobody left to hear me, my dad and Steve Jobs were friends.
Dad got issued bonds for Apple and has hidden them somewhere.
Like a safety deposit box, Peter asks. When did my dad ever use a bank? I think back on my childhood and never recall my dad ever using a credit card or having an ATM card. He paid cash for everything.
How much stock are we talking about? Peter asks.
$1,000 worth. I see Peter do some mental math in that geek way that investors do.
That's worth about $9 million today, he announces.
Shh, I hiss.
How do we find this mystery money? Peter asks.
It starts with a brick. Let's go to Mom's house, I suggest.
The house is sold, Jess. We can't go there anymore.
I'll figure something out along the way. Let's just go to the house.